Red Film Radio.
Red Film Radio.
Interview.
Interview.
Usually on the Big Fret Tuesday, I like to dedicate a chunk of the show to film history. Well, on this episode, we're going to be talking about one of the festivals that really celebrates film heritage and film history better than many others, possibly any other. The Giornate del Cinema Muto, aka the Pordenone Silent Film Festival. And we're going to do it with its artistic director, Jay Weisberg, who, aside from also being an excellent film critic, is also one of the most passionate film scholars I know. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
So, Jay, it's great to hear your voice. And this year's edition of the Giornate del Cinema Muto, the Pordenone Silent Film Festival, for those who don't know, was a limited edition. Now, can you explain to the folks at home, especially those who don't know, why this year's Giornate was a limited edition and what that actually means?
Sure. Pretty early on during the lockdown this year, we realized that it was going to be impossible to do a live event. And that was true for a number of reasons. One, we have an international audience, be it people who are coming from Japan, from Brazil, from the US, from Argentina, from all over the world. And we knew it was going to be impossible for them to come. And I didn't like the idea of presenting something live, even if it were possible, which in the end it really wouldn't have been. But I didn't like the idea of presenting something live that would have excluded a significant number of our regular attendees. But on top of that also was the problem of archives. The archives had all locked down, of course, like every other institution and every other business, which meant that all restorations had stopped, all digitization projects had stopped. There was no way that I could have put together the thematic program that I had already planned for a live event. So we realized, okay, we needed to go virtual. And then that opened up a whole other can of worms, in a sense, or maybe it's better to say it opened up other vistas, if I'm going to put a positive spin on it, which included how many films could we show. And one of the things that I was arguing is that nobody's taking a week off from work, if they have work in this period, for a virtual festival. So we needed to limit it in that way as well. So what we managed to do was one film program a day, two programs on the weekends for the 8 days of the festival. And that was always accompanied by special content. So there were various parts of the festival that we were keen on maintaining. That included master classes from the musicians. So in this case, there were some that were taped beforehand and two that were live, in which people could also interact with the musicians and live chat and that sort of thing. We had book presentations. Again, those were live, so people could ask questions. And then after every film performance, which always had live music, not live music, excuse me, which always had music that was recorded for each film. After each one, there was always a discussion that included the musician, generally an archivist and a scholar.
So we had talked earlier in the year about how the festival would respond to the pandemic. And actually, you mentioned it there. I believe that compared to the vast majority of festivals I know, the Giornate's response was quick and confident, I feel. But would I be right in saying that? And also, do you believe that the quickness sort of helped you face the challenges of responding to these COVID times? Because there's a lot obviously involved in going online with a film program.
It's funny. I'm glad you felt that it was quick. I felt it could have been a little bit quicker. I wanted us to make the announcement at the beginning of May, but we decided to hold off for several more weeks until we had a better picture, or we hoped we would have a better picture of what the landscape was going to look like. But absolutely, making that announcement as early as we did helped significantly, because we still had to deal with archives. We still had to get films for this. It meant when we decided to cancel the live event, it meant that I had to completely rethink what films we're going to show. None of the films that I had planned were part of this year's limited edition. I had to go to all of the archives, well, not all of the archives, obviously, but various archives, and say, okay, what do you have for me? What do you have that's been recently digitized that I can show within a framework where I wanted to both keep the silent film community connected, as they always are during the live event, but also welcome a new audience. So taking advantage of the fact that we're online meant that all of the people who aren't normally able to travel to Portinoni in October, and that could be for financial reasons, that could be, let's say, professors who are teaching during that time of the year, students as well as people who maybe have, you know, thought that, yeah, they've seen some silent films that they kind of liked, but they wouldn't think about coming to a festival for 8 days of only silent film. So the idea that we were online allowed them to access it. And because we kept the accreditation as cheap as we did, a basic pass was €9.90. And that meant you had access to everything for the entire week. That helped also enormously. And because of that, we were able to double our accreditation.
So in the end, it was very successful.
Yeah, it really was. I was delighted, and we all were. And it was, you know, it was bittersweet in some ways. And each evening after the live conversations that we would have, that I would moderate, I would shut down my computer, of course. And then there was this kind of feeling of emptiness, because normally what happens is after the last screenings, you go out and you see your colleagues, you see your friends, you get some drinks and you discuss the movies and you soak up the energy from each other. And there's a great deal of adrenaline and just enjoyment. And of course, that was lacking. But because the feedback was so overwhelmingly positive, because I was involved in the chats during the conversations, checking out social media, all of that sort of thing, I did feel that we were connected again. And just that alone helped, you know, move through it and helped me realize that, no, we'd achieved our goals. And that is, as I said a little bit earlier, keeping the Portinoni family together, but also expanding it.
You know, we talked earlier in the year, actually, you had mentioned the blog that you'd started, The Silent Cat. I also noticed that on the website, then there was The Silent Stream too, probably, I don't know whether that is true, what I'm about to say, but maybe helped you guys a little bit, just test out the technologies and maybe what was possible and not possible on the online world.
I think that's probably true, because we did The Silent Stream before the festival began. And The Silent Stream, the idea is that every couple of months through the Cineteca del Friuli, which is our parent organization, we're putting films that we have screened at the Giornate, at the festival from the past, with a musical accompaniment for about 2 months. And on The Silent Stream, everything is free and it's all accessible via the festival website, whereas the festival itself that we did, our limited edition, was all through mymovies.it, which is a terrific platform that helped us guarantee the level of quality, both sound as well as visual quality.
Oh yeah, the level of quality, I must say, was really good.
Yeah, I was just so pleased. And it was great because My Movies, because they've done other festivals before, they also did the Far East Film Festival in Udine and other ones, because they had already done that, it meant that they could deal with the accreditation process, all of the sorts of things that we as a festival and the Cineteca as an institution hadn't had experience before. So we were very, very grateful for that partnership.
Yeah, I must say that the quality was really, really high, really good. And also it was easy to use. Sometimes, you know, it can be quite confusing, especially for people who are not tech savvy. But I think that also the fact that it was easily accessible definitely would have helped the overall experience, you know, because as we mentioned, the Giornate del Cinema Muto is renowned for its physical experience for several different reasons. But I gather that on the other hand, there were also positives in being forced to hold this edition online this year. Do you feel like perhaps this is something that you could continue to do in future editions of the festival, always hoping that, of course, even, you know, beginning with next year, we'll be able to actually go to travel to Pordenone and actually experience these films live?
Absolutely. We've been talking, in fact, about how we need to maintain some kind of online presence even during the live festival, because it would be foolish at this point to toss away this audience that we've attracted. So many people have told me over the years, oh, one day when I retire, I want to come to Pordenone. Well, that, you know, why, if we can jump on that beforehand through online content, then that's something that we need to continue to do. It won't be the same thing as a festival. How many films we'd be able to stream, I don't know right now, but certainly we need to maintain some kind of virtual presence in coming years.
So we talked about the film program being considerably smaller this year for a variety of reasons, but that doesn't mean that the program did not offer plenty of chances for making amazing early cinema discoveries or rediscoveries. Now, I know that I myself made lots of great discoveries, but for the benefit of the people listening, would you maybe be able to give us an overview of the program? And I'm just going to let you say as much as you like, because I truly enjoy hearing you talk about film history, including via the Pordenone Silent Film Festival overviews that we have done in the past for previous editions of the festival.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. Yes, sure. When I was putting the program together, as I said, normally we do thematic programming. That was impossible, so I needed to think, what did I want to show? And I wanted to capture the breadth of silent cinema, which meant from as early as possible to as late as possible, and to incorporate as many countries as possible. So we had films from 1897 up through 1935, with actually one short from 1939, which was made as a sound short, but the soundtrack has been lost, so that's kind of cheating in a way, but not really. And that included things from, for the most part, it was American European centric, in the sense that we had no films from Latin America this year, but I did have one film from China, and I had an American film which exists only in Japan with a Japanese cast. So I tried very much to give a sense of the variety of silent film. I wanted to include famous names like Cecil B. DeMille, G.W. Pabst, Mary Pickford, as well as people who have been largely sidelined and forgotten by the general public, even by a lot of specialists as well. So that was another important element for me. The only part of the festival that was at all thematic was the opening program, which was called The Urge to Travel. And that came out of a desire that I had, and I think I talked about this the last time we spoke, a desire I had to kind of capture that sense that so many of us are feeling of wanting to escape the four walls of lockdown and go back to the lives that we led, which meant traveling to places that we love, as well as traveling to new locations. So with the nine shorts that we had, that I selected, it was New York in 1911. It was London in 1921. I'm going blank right now, but I think that's right. Cairo in the late 1920s. Trieste, that was the 1939 film. All these places that the images were so beautiful. Bruges in 1922, which just was stunning. It made you yearn to be in those locations, and that was what I really wanted to capture. And I was very happy that so many other people told me how meaningful it was to be watching that program, because they also experienced the same things that I was looking for. So that was really nice. And then we tried also, because every Wednesday evening during the festival, we have what we call sort of the midweek event, which is an orchestral event. This year, obviously, we couldn't have an orchestral live event, but what we did have is there's a 1930 Greek film called The Apaches of Athens. It's actually The Apache of Athens, because it's not about Native Americans in Greece, but Apache was the term that was used in the early part of the 20th century to describe these sort of working class, fairly dangerous communities who would hang out in bars and get kind of violent and dance and drink and those sorts of things. So so the Greek Film Archive had restored a print of this previously considered lost film from 1930, which was found at the Cinémathèque Française, but without a soundtrack. It had an original soundtrack on discs, but that's been lost. But it was based on an operetta, so the Greek Film Archive commissioned some a music scholar to recompose, in a sense, the score. And it was presented in Athens in February, just before lockdown, and we had it as a live event with the recording that was made in February. So that was great, too, to be able to recapture that, to give value to Greek silent cinema, which is a national cinema that's pretty much completely unknown, because so little was made and even less exists. So all of these things were also a nice way of giving a sense of what the Jurnati is, that it's a place of making discoveries like this, of discovering cinemas that most people aren't aware of, but also then seeing something like the Pabst film, Abwege, which is, I think, an amazing film made just before Pandora's Box and Diary of a Lost Girl. So it doesn't have the same cachet, obviously it doesn't have Louise Brooks, but it does have Birgitte Helm, who I adore, even though she does polarize people because she is so mannered in her performances, in the way that she moves. But she's, for me, it's not that she's really a woman of flesh and blood. She's representing a kind of womanhood in the way that she moves and the way that she acts. And I think if you look at it from that point of view, it opens it up in different ways. But so Abwege is one of the Pabst films that's often left out of the canon. It's often not really discussed in even in books about the director. And yet it's a very important film set in late 1920s Berlin. It enters into the cabaret world, the decadence of, or what we like to think of as the decadent world of Weimar Germany at the time. So it was great to have that film as well, for example. But then, sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. Then having something called The Brilliant Biograph, which was put together by the iFilm Museum in Amsterdam from their 68mm holdings of early film. Now, 68mm is a gauge, obviously, that doesn't exist anymore. It had a very short life. But if you can think of 70mm and the incredible quality that we have now when there are films that are done in 70mm, 68, you can imagine the visual beauty is very similar. For decades and decades, these films could not be properly restored. They don't have sprocket holes, so they couldn't go through scanning machines. Now, with digital technology, it's much, much easier, and so they've done these extraordinary scans, frame by frame, of films from 1897 to 1902 that just blow your mind away, because you can't believe that the quality is so clear, that the past feels so close. And that was another thing that I really wanted to emphasize, particularly for people who aren't used to watching silent films, who think of these things as very distant from us, being very archaic, all of that bullshit, because people aren't used to seeing them. They're not used to seeing them screened in the correct ratio, screened at the correct speed, and with the right music. And that was, of course, also a key element in all of this, was that we asked all of our regular musicians to record scores for all the films that were shown. And as usual, they did an amazing job.
Yeah, so there's so much that could be said about, you know, I mentioned that it was a smaller in size, the program was, but there's so much that could be said about the films that were presented that yeah. I feel like, you know, another film that I wanted to mention as well, because it was probably one of my favorites of this year, and certainly one of my favorite discoveries from this year was La Tempesta in un Cranio, which I don't know what the translation, the English title would be for that film, but
it was released in the UK actually with the title Kill or Cure,
right.
But the literal translation, we're going back and forth, is it Storm in the Cranium, is it Storm in the Head, I mean, however you want to put it, but I love the title because it just seems so appropriate for this particular moment in time as well.
Yeah, and again, when we talk about like Italian cinema from the time, we think of these epics, but then this is something that's quite different. It's delightful and very clever, I thought. So definitely a great discovery from this year's program.
Yeah, I think the Italian cinema after the First World War has been so undervalued. And it is true that the industry collapsed leading up to and through the First World War. It was one of the top industries in the world, but for various reasons, it collapsed right after. And there was a great kind of talent drain. So many Italian actors left. Far fewer films are being made, but there are still wonderful things that are waiting for discovery. And this was a print that was found at the Cineteca Italiana in Milan. The director was Carlo Campogalliani, who continued making films through the 60s with major names. He's fairly well known here in Italy, but he's been completely forgotten outside. And back in the late teens and 20s, he was acting as both on both sides of the camera. He was director as well as actor. So this really gave a wonderful picture of this extraordinarily energetic, playful character. The film is also a kind of gentle ribbing at psychoanalysis, but not demonizing it either, which is really nice. And it's just a delight.
Yeah, I read in the program that Campogalliani was sometimes referred to in the media as the Italian Fairbanks, which sort of made me smile. Anyways, I knew that we would go on a bit longer for this interview because there's so much to talk about, and it's so great to talk about these films. I mean, they're so valuable. But I wanted to definitely mention that, you know, we spoke earlier about the physical experience that the Giornate del Cinema Muto is renowned for. And I must say that part of it does come from the city of Pordenone itself, which is a beautiful city. I think we can all agree, anyone who's been there. But which is why I thought the video introductions to the films that you shot at various locations in the city were a really nice touch.
Thanks. They were fun to do, I must say. They were really fun. And it was a way for us to bring people literally back into the city, to introduce people who don't know Pordenone to the town. We were very conscious of the fact that when the festival happens, it's a great economic boost to the city. The restaurants are full, the hotels are full, people are buying in the shops. And the fact that the city didn't have that was an economic blow. So what do you do? How do you remind people of the wonders of the city and give them a shot of nostalgia for the people who are used to going, and for those who aren't, give them a taste of what they will hopefully experience themselves in a year.
So another thing that I wanted to mention is that these times of the coronavirus have obviously been tough for so many industries, including the film industry, and certainly for the film preservation sector. And that includes film archives and cinematheques, which are already vulnerable institutions. And we've been hearing worrying and even shocking news about so many of them in different parts of the world, including the Cinemateca Brasileira in Brazil, but many others as well, whose funds have been cut and whose future and the future of the films they preserve are at great risk. Which is why I felt that the fact that before the screenings, the Giornate showed videos that took us right inside the archives so that we could see just how much work is involved in the preservation of film were so valuable. Also because in general, most people don't know anything about what difficult but valuable work that is. So I definitely appreciated seeing those videos that you guys included in the program from all of those different archives of different parts of the world.
I'm really glad that you brought that up and you said that, because cinematheques are notoriously underfunded by governments, really to a ridiculous degree. For the cinematheques that are connected to museums, they're often the bastard stepchild of those institutions. In terms of publications, they rarely have publications. Very few DVDs come out of them. And this is all not because the will isn't there, but because the funding isn't there. Because, as usual, early cinema, and by early cinema, I mean anything from before last year at this point, is always undervalued. It's considered that, oh, well, you know, we've got it on DVD, or if it's not on DVD, maybe it's not worth being on DVD, or it's a commercial thing, so leave it to the private sector, or what have you. But there are thousands of marvelous films that are literally disintegrating as we speak because there aren't the funds to preserve them. So we need to constantly remind the public that the archives are doing a service for world culture, for world humanity. There is no better way of understanding not only our neighbors and ourselves, but also our past than through cinema. And to have that connection, to have that visual connection is irreplaceable. And yet, as I said, every moment something is disintegrating. That exists only in a unique copy. So we need to be more aware. We need to be more proactive. And there are certain archives that are. So the Danish Film Institute has been given an amazing grant by the Danish government to digitize every Danish silent film and then put it online and make it accessible. And that's phenomenal. Nobody else is doing that. But you've got, you know, in that case, you've got a rich country, relatively rich, that somebody in the government understood. We have plenty of other very rich countries. The United States is a major example that doesn't give a toss. You know, the finding the funds to preserve films is really, really hard. And they're hardly alone. So we need to be aware of this. We need to constantly underline the heroic efforts of archives to preserve our heritage.
And we definitely could get into a discussion of why that might be, but we probably should avoid that. Also, because it would definitely extend our interview far too long. But let's go back to the contemporary times, and this will be the sort of a conclusive topic of this conversation, because throughout the year, you, like me, like other journalists, critics, and just people who are active at film festivals everywhere, are very used to traveling a lot and going to different film festivals all over the world. And since we last spoke, festivals have reacted in different ways. Some decided to just, carry on with the physical edition. Others went entirely online. Some did a sort of a hybrid edition, and so on. Just also in terms of your work as a film critic and just someone who goes to festivals a lot, what are your views on how generally film festivals have responded to the pandemic, especially since the last time we talked, so early June?
Yeah. My views aren't positive. And then maybe I'm going to get into trouble for what I'm going to say, but I have been appalled at the hubris of so many festivals who have been determined to carry on as if there isn't a pandemic, claiming that the precautions that they're putting into place are enough. But at the same time, I'm hearing from so many colleagues who are afraid to go to certain festivals, who are afraid to attend because they're concerned about the contagion. But if they don't attend, they're not going to get any money. And we all have to pay our rent. But what kind of festival puts its public at risk, its colleagues at risk? What kind of festival forces its industry into a situation where they are afraid and then ignores that fear makes me furious. You know, I found an amazing article from 1918, December 1918, during the flu pandemic of that year. And the author said, "We believe the proprietor of a moving picture house will have every excuse for keeping close watch upon the health of his patrons at all times in the future." When I read that line, when I discovered that line, when I was going through this is Moving Picture World, when I discovered that, it really hit home, because I thought, yes, exactly. We have a responsibility to our patrons. We have a responsibility to our public. And I fully appreciate the financial implications of all of this. I fully appreciate that we want the show to go on. We're all experiencing this sense of loss. And also, there are people who are saying, you know, actually going into a theater with every other row and every other seat empty is a very safe place to be. that may be true, but a festival isn't just what happens in the cinema at that moment while you're watching the movie. It's the congregation, the congregating inside and outside. It's the discussions. It's the bringing people together. It's all of those sorts of things. And ultimately, that's not controllable. And we're all tired. We're tired of lockdown. We're tired of masks. We're tired of all of that. And what's happened because of that being tired is that social distancing is flying out the window. And that's why we're seeing the numbers going as high as they are. So for some place like, excuse me, but for the Lumière Festival in Lyon last month, you look at the photographs of packed houses, of people on stage without masks, and you're thinking, what the hell? What is there about the need to be on stage and have everybody applaud you that trumps the health of your spectators? Why is our privilege more important than our public's health? I don't understand this, and it makes me angry, clearly.
It's good. Yeah, it's good to document that anger. I feel I agree with you. It's really interesting what you pointed out about that article, because you mentioned it's from 1918. Back then, obviously, they wouldn't have had such things as the internet and, the ability to watch films even from the comfort of their home. And yet they were thinking of health and safety. And that's something.
And in December 1918, the cinemas that were open were doing every other seat and every other row in many cities. So the precautions that we put into place now, they were putting into place back in 1918 as well. And still, you know, his mantra is, and it should be our mantra: we need to keep close watch upon the health of our patrons. That's how you instill confidence, I think. Not by forcing people into situations where they feel uneasy.
Absolutely. Jay, time really has flown during this past half hour. Can you believe it? We've been talking for half hour. But it's been great. It's been wonderful. I'd love to just continue, but we have to draw the line somewhere. But we should do this again soon, I think. So thank you very much for doing this. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, Matt. It's been great.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.